The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Reoccurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder how a loving God could possibly send people to hell. Actually, God would not be loving if he didn't send people to hell. Now, I know that's going to sound bizarre to a lot of you, but we will discuss this provocative subject later on in the program. Welcome to Super Bowl Sunday. Glad to have you listening, both of you. I know I make that same joke every year because I'm stupid enough to be broadcasting on Super Bowl Sunday every year. But if you heard the joke before, then that means you're one of the two that's listening, right? Actually, I have been surprised how many people do listen and sometimes even call in on Super Bowl Sunday. If you'd like to give us a call, let us know you're out there. I would be delighted to hear from you. And of course, you may be listening to our repeat Saturday evening broadcast or over the internet at your convenience. So the Super Bowl may be a non-issue anyhow. But if you are listening in real time to this coveted radio show time slot, 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoons, I'm glad you're here. And to reward you for listening, I'm going to begin this program by solving one of the greatest mysteries of all time. Now, I suspect this is a problem with males more than females, but I must confess, I have absolutely no idea how my socks disappear. I'm not kidding. I wish I was. I do a load of laundry. After taking my clothes out of the dryer, I find that I only washed one pair of socks when I had been quite certain that two or three pairs were put in. Or I put in one pair, but only one of the two socks comes out, his twin brother being nowhere in sight. Well, there is a workable theory. Listen carefully. You see, it has to do with quantum physics, the origin of the universe, and the altering of our space-time continuum. More specifically, how those puzzles intersect with the Bermuda Triangle, hijacking its properties long enough to replicate a miniaturized yet similar phenomenon that connects to all washers and dryers. You don't think so? No? Okay, fine. I challenge you to offer a better explanation. In the meantime, off I go to Walmart for more socks. Perhaps stranger than the Bermuda Triangle is our president's foreign policy, especially in the midst of a crisis that engulfs the whole globe, such as the situation in Egypt, and now they say it's spreading to Jordan. Well, be of good cheer. Your old pal Bob will explain our president's procedure. It's quite simple, really. President Obama's foreign policy. I urge both sides to show restraint. That's it. He urges both sides to show restraint. Just fill in the name of the particular country or countries. His policy remains the same. This doesn't work particularly well in the Middle East. We need a president who understands the Middle East.
When Bob Siegel says President Obama doesn't understand the Middle East, he doesn't mean to imply that he knows absolutely nothing about the Middle East.
Thank you, Dan. We always appreciate the special assistance of Disclaimer Dan.
Actually, President Obama is aware that there is a whole side of the world called the East. And he does know that the Middle East is in the middle of it.
And then, of course, there's President Obama's domestic policy. Well, he reviewed that during his State of the Union message. Since the beginning of the year, leading all the way up to the State of the Union message 2 weeks ago, and even since then, we have been inundated with a plethora of pundits announcing that Obama, out of strategy and a desire to get reelected after reading the November elections writing on the wall, is moving to the center. The center. Actually, our president is much more strategic than people give him credit for. He talks as if he has moved to the center while espousing the same old policies. Following the Arizona shooting, Obama urged people to tone down the intense political speech, but failed to say anything when 1 week later Representative Steve Cohen compared all who oppose our recent health care law to Nazis. The explanation for this inconsistency is simple. Cohen is a Democrat. Inflamed rhetoric is defined as a disease of conservatives. When liberals do the same thing, it's only healthy dissent in the rich tradition of our freedoms. And then in the face of pro-life protests in Washington, Obama reminded our country that women need to have the same opportunities as men. This, of course, was code for saying that mothers should have a right to kill their unborn babies. But Obama is smart enough not to phrase it that way. Otherwise, people might think about what is actually happening during an abortion. Indeed, our president's lexicon includes a whole host of nice-sounding words whose meanings are seldom pondered. Bipartisanship is a perfect example. Most of the time, it means that Republicans should do things the way Democrats want them done. But this year's State of the Union was the topper of them all. The key State of the Union word was invest. Invest, you see, means borrowing more money to stimulate the economy once again. He's probably hoping we've already forgotten his previous stimulus package and the crackerjack job it did of fixing our financial crisis. Personal favorites include, and we've talked about them on the show before, $2 million for swine odor research in Iowa, $300,000 for helicopters to hunt radioactive rabbit droppings at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington State, and $3.1 million to transform a canal barge into a floating museum that will travel the Erie Canal in New York State. And then there was the $219,000 for Syracuse University to study the sex lives of freshman women. And I tried to make this point before, but nobody is listening. Aren't there already enough freshman males who will volunteer to conduct this study for free? More examples of Obama's move to the center include his insistence that the children of illegal aliens be entitled to an American college education, his glee that gays can now serve openly in the military, and a ringing endorsement of last year's brand spanking new health care law. If this is a trek to the center, geometric rules must have changed while nobody was looking. To be fair, Obama offered to make a few microscopic adjustments in the interest of bipartisanship. But for the most part, this magician's act of announcing clear skies while it's raining outside seems polished as ever. How does he pull off such an interesting phenomenon? How does he insist that he's anchored in the center while moving further and further to the left right before our eyes? Probably because he hopes America is just that stupid, or at least sincerely misled. When he remembers that he got elected the first time, his hope is nourished. We live in very precarious times. There is hope that it can be turned around, hope for a revival, but it will take a miracle. Meanwhile, we are stuck with a president who displays little more than incompetence in his foreign policy. True, he knows exactly what he's doing on the domestic front. Unfortunately, what he is doing is systematically destroying the America we have grown to love in the hopes of replacing it with some progressive socialistic experiment. Hold on to your seats. It's going to be a nasty ride.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if woman can survive, they may find
gonna need to tell the truth, tell no lies. Everything you think, do, and say is in the pill you took today. In the year 45, 45, ain't gonna need your teeth, won't need your eyes. You won't find a thing to chew. Nobody's gonna look at you. In the year 55, 55, your arms are hanging limp at your sides. Your legs got nothing to do. Some machine doing that for you. In the year 65, 65, ain't gonna need no husband, won't need no wife. You pick your son, pick your daughter too, from the bottom of a long glass tube. Whoa, whoa. In the year 7510, if God's a-coming, he ought to make it by then. Maybe he'll look around himself and say, guess it's time for the judgment day. In the year 8510, God is gonna shake his mighty head. He'll either say I'm pleased where man has been, or tear it down and start again. Whoa, whoa. In the year 9595, I'm kinda wondering if man is gonna be alive. He's taken everything this old earth can give, and he ain't put back nothing. Whoa, whoa. Now it's been 10,000 years. Man has cried a billion tears for what he never knew. Now man's reign is through, but through eternal night, the twinkling of starlight, so very far away, maybe it's only yesterday. In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if woman can survive, they may find.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to our program. The verbal battle over American-Egyptian policy goes back and forth. Yes, President Mubarak has ruled as a ruthless dictator. Yes, the idea of overthrowing this man and replacing his rule with an honest democracy sounds pleasant. Sounds that way. But when the fine hand of Muslim Brotherhood appears to be pulling the marionette strings, one asks if Egypt's potential revolution will simply pull people out of the frying pan and into the fire. The Muslim Brotherhood, for example, is not particularly shy about its goal of liquidating Jewish inhabitants in the Holy Land. There has been no love lost between Israel and Egypt over the years, and Egypt probably never would have agreed to the current peace treaty if not for an eagerness to regain control over the Sinai, taken by Israel after Egypt attempted to wipe Israel off the face of the map back in the Six-Day War. Still, for whatever reasons, Egypt, under its present form of government, is at least technically at peace with Israel. This will change immediately after the Muslim Brotherhood. Although few Americans would believe or admit, even if they did believe, that Israel should be destroyed, far too many are willing, nevertheless, to throw a good deal of the blame Israel's direction as a result of her illegal occupation of Palestine, supposedly. There are few subjects laced with more historical revision than the subject of the Middle East. For a tragic example, One need look no further than former President Jimmy Carter insisting that Jews shut up peace talks, even with the terrorist group Hamas. And who could forget that darling Washington correspondent Helen Thomas and her call for Jews to get the blankety blank out of Palestine? True, she apologized out of fear for her job. Then after losing her job anyway, she admitted that the statement leaves her with no moral regrets. Speaking to Scott Pierce on local Ohio station WNRN, 1490 AM, back in October of 2010, Thomas said, "I had to apologize because as everyone was so upset, I hit the third rail. You cannot criticize Israel in this country and survive." Helen, have you been out to a university? What do you mean you can't criticize Israel in this country and survive? People do it all the time. When Spears asked why she made the comment in the first place, Thomas says, "Because it's the truth. The Israelis, they're very aggressive. They have refused to enforce or go along with some 65 UN resolutions." Isn't it interesting how people always love to talk about the UN resolutions, but the UN resolution that created Israel in the first place, that was somehow illegal. Interesting logic. Now, one might be tempted to comment on the utter ignorance of a prestigious journalist, but such a comment would garner fierce resistance from many sincere, misled people. Unfortunately, we have reached a point where one cannot defend Israel anymore without sounding as if he is supporting some imperial aggressor, even though Israel is a tiny country smaller than the state of New Jersey. And yet, despite this size, Israel seems to be the concern of countries all over the world, regardless of which hemisphere they inhabit or which ocean they border. And so, in order to defend Israel more accurately, we review this subject from time to time on The Bob Siegel Show. I repeat this ever so often because virtually, you will hear this no place else. I mean, obviously, I'm not the only one talking about it, but as I said, virtually, generally speaking, you will not hear this side in any other venue. Certainly not on our college campuses or through today's news media. Question: do the Jews even have a right to be in the Middle East at all? Wasn't there a group of indigenous people called the Palestinians living there since the beginning of measured history? Didn't Jews arrive after World War II and conquer land that did not belong to them? Utterly and completely false. The Jews lived in the land since the time of Moses and, despite some upsets from the Syrians and Babylonians, remained in the land for some 2,000 years until the Romans displaced them. Prince Titus destroyed the temple in 70 AD. Then in the second century, Emperor Hadrian crushed a new Jewish rebellion, this time many of the Jews were banished and others were made slaves of the Romans. A small number of Jews did stay in the land and remained there up through the 20th century. Let me say that again. A small number of Jews did stay in the land and remained there right up through the 20th century. However, the name of the land at that time was changed because Hadrian wanted to destroy Jewish identity. He renamed the land Syria Palestina. Palestine was a Latin version of the word Philistine, an ancient enemy of the Jews who were now extinct as a people. Hadrian was deliberately insulting the Jews. There has never been a country called Palestine. This was a nickname for the Holy Land under the Romans. The people who today call themselves Palestinians are Arabs, and they referred to themselves as Arabs for centuries until they were dubbed Palestinians as a publicity ploy by the terrorist and founder of the PLO, Yasser Arafat, who himself did not use the title Palestinian until after the year 1964. You're going, okay, Bob, well, even if this is true, well, then, all right, these Arabs at least lived in that land for centuries. Well, in ancient times, Arabs could be found in many places, but they did not occupy the Holy Land in any significant number until after the time of Muhammad in the 600s and the spread of Islam. Muslims conquered the land from the Byzantine Church, remnants of the converted Roman Empire. Through the years, with crusades and other wars, the land switched ownership back and forth between the Catholic Church and the Muslims. Eventually, it fell into the hands of another Muslim empire, the Ottomans. After defeating the Ottomans in World War I, the Middle East found itself under the domain of Great Britain. Now, even though the Middle East became a prize of the British Empire, England had neither the desire nor ability to run that region of the world forever. For this reason, they began working to create a series of new states in which the Arabs, who had helped them defeat the Ottoman Empire, could administer their own affairs. Although the term Arabia was already a general description for a large part of this area, many of the Middle East countries we know of today did not officially become independent nations until the British occupation and subsequent withdrawal from this turbulent region of the world. While working to create new multiple states, Great Britain, with the cooperation of the League of Nations, an early prototype of the United Nations, decided they would also offer an opportunity for Jews all over the world to return to their homeland. This invitation was called the Balfour Declaration. Needless to say, grateful Jews responded with terrific enthusiasm. Indeed, many children of Abraham did migrate from Russia, Western Europe, and other corners of the globe, where they had lived for some 2,000 years in ghettos, at the mercy of pogroms or harsh policies of anti-Semitic governments. A homeland of their own had been a hopeful vision to the Jews for two millennia. The most familiar Jewish toast comment at Passover celebrations said, "Next year in Jerusalem," but few thought they were reciting much more than a pipe dream. Now they could really, truly return to Jerusalem. Just imagine how this must have felt. The Jews were going to sojourn to a country of their own, and not just any country, the very land of their ancestors, a land where a remnant of Jews had remained since ancient times, living side by side with Muslims and Christians who also had interests in Palestine and now viewed it as their holy land too. So what exactly was offered to the Hebrew immigrants by the League of Nations? Listen to what was offered to them. Everything we would today call Israel, everything we would today call Jordan, and most of what we would today call the occupied territories. When the Jews arrived, many of them purchased land from Arab lords. In time, a terrain had been little more than a desolate, flea-bitten combination of swamp and desert, swiftly turned green with farmland and transplanted trees. The economy also boomed, transforming this area in such an amazing way that the term metamorphosis barely does justice. New jobs were created, resulting in an influx of Arabs from other regions who now saw Palestine as a land of opportunity and employment made possible by Jewish farmers and businessmen recently arrived from Europe. What was the proportion of Arab and Jew in Palestine prior to the Balfour Declaration? More Arabs than Jews inhabited the land at this time, resulting from previous Muslim expansion. But the truth is, there was really only a handful of each people group because, again, the swamp-like conditions limited the kind of life one could realistically enjoy in the Holy Land. The famous author Mark Twain wrote as much after his own personal visit. He was surprised how desolate the Holy Land looked, how little was going on there, and how few people inhabited the area. All of this changed when the League of Nations invited Jews to resettle their ancient home. Ironically, it was after Jewish business created a surplus of jobs that Arabs flooded into the territory en masse, creating a situation where the Arabs greatly outnumbered the Jews. In paradoxical fashion, the British, after inviting the Jews to return, sold over 75% of Palestine to the Arabs, creating a new country called Transjordan. This is an extremely important and seldom taught fact. Please catch this. 75% of what had been offered to the Jews was sold behind their backs to Arabs instead. Not only were the Arabs offered a separate Palestinian state long ago, they have been living in one since the early part of the 20th century. It's called Jordan, a country three times the size of what remained for the Jews. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480539, W&S Electric. Seventy-5% of what was offered to the Jews by the League of Nations, 75% of the land was sold behind their back, and the state of Jordan was created. The Jews accepted this betrayal only because they had no choice. After all, a sliver of the promise was better than no land at all. But the Arabs didn't want the Jews to have even a sliver, and fresh controversy broke out over what to do with the remaining 25%. To appease the Arabs, the United Nations voted to divvy up the remaining 25% between the Jews and the Arabs. Now listen to me carefully. The Jews accepted this partition. The Jews accepted this partition. The Arabs did not. After the partition vote from the United Nations, Israel declared its independence on May 14, 1948. One day later, five Arab armies invaded Israel from Egypt, Transjordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. A very important note here. This war had nothing to do with allowing a two-state solution. Indeed, the Arabs waged war because they were rejecting a two-state solution. Their stated goal was the complete extermination of Israel. These were the words of Abid Saud, king of Saudi Arabia, in 1947. There are 50 million Arabs. What does it matter if we lose 10 million to kill all of the Jews? The price is worth it. This is from Azam Pasha, Secretary General of the Arab League in 1947. This will be a war of extermination and momentous massacre, which will be spoken of like the Mongolian massacres. From El Hussein, Mufti of Jerusalem in 1947, I declare a holy war on my Muslim brothers. Murder the Jews. Murder them all. Jews pleaded with Palestinian Arabs to remain in their homes. Although many of the Arabs did flee or join the invading armies, a considerable portion of Arabs remained in Israel. This interesting fact is seldom discussed. About 300,000 Arabs fled Israel, and about 160,000 remain. Today, Israel still contains a vital Arab population, and these Arabs have more rights in Israel than any Arab in any Arab country. In fact, shortly before Yasser Arafat's death, when there was talk, once again, under the Bush administration, of a separate Palestinian state, the Arab citizens in Israel were asked if they wanted to move, renouncing their Israeli citizenship, and live in the Palestine sector. Guess what they decided? Some of them probably fell on the floor laughing before saying to the Israeli government, oh, I'm sorry, you were serious. In 1948, when Israel beat the odds and defeated five invading nations, the problem of refugees came up. We always hear about the Arab refugees from Israel, but they were not the only refugees. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were kicked out of Arab lands. All of the Jewish refugees were welcomed into Israel, whereas Arabs who wanted to resettle in Arab countries were, for the most part, denied admission. Jordan was an exception, but even in Jordan, most of the refugees were confined to camps. They lived in that condition all the way up to 1967, when Israel annexed Jordan's West Bank, only because Jordan was going to attack Israel. Prior to 1967, there was no significant ongoing discussion amongst the countries of the world regarding Jordan's treatment of the poor Palestinians. On December 11th, 1948, the United Nations drafted and ratified Resolution 194. This was a call for the Arab states and Israel to resolve the refugee settlement issues, but the condition was that all returning citizens would agree to live in peace. Receiving no such guarantee from the Arabs, Israel decided to postpone repatriation until her neighbors would recognize her right to exist. In 1967, nine different nations, Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Algeria, Kuwait, Sudan, and Saudi Arabia, and Iraq, declared a war on Israel and promised to exterminate every Jew. I'm reading from Radio Cairo, May 17, 1967. Egypt is ready to plunge into a total war that will be the end of Israel. Surprising the world with a preemptive strike, Israel defeated the Arabs in just 6 days. At that time, their territory was expanded to the West Bank, the Golan Heights, the Gaza Strip, the Sinai, and the remainder of Jerusalem, half of which had been taken over by Jordan after the 1947 war. This territory is frequently referred to as part of Israel's illegal occupation. I tend to hate that term, and I argue against it for the following reasons. First of all, when we think of occupying countries, what usually comes to mind is an aggressive empire seeking to conquer and expand, not a tiny little nation that expanded its borders only as a means of survival to prevent her untrustworthy neighbors from attacking again. Two, most of the land had been legally offered to Israel in the Balfour Declaration anyway, before Great Britain sold it behind Israel's back. Three, historically, the land had been the home of the Jews for literally thousands of years. For the United Nations has become so corrupt, I no longer accept their standard as to what is legal or illegal. This is not to say that Israel has not given back land or made peace treaties. The Sinai has been returned, and other territories have slowly transferred to the Palestinian authorities. But, folks, when two nations make a peace treaty, there's supposed to be give and take on both sides. Israel's deal, brokered by the United States, always goes like this. You give the Palestinians back some land, and why, here's what they will do. They'll promise to stop killing you. Sound fair? That's the deal. Then shortly after the deal, the promise is broken and missiles are fired into Israel from Gaza, where the Palestinians were finally offered their own autonomous rule, or a suicide bomber kills women and children on a bus. Let me be as straight with my listeners as I possibly can. Nothing Israel does, no gesture, no concession, no discussion, will make a hill of beans of difference. They can sign a peace treaty. They can jump on board for a two-state solution. It doesn't matter. Hezbollah wants Israel dead. Al-Qaeda wants Israel dead. Hamas wants Israel dead. Muslim Brotherhood wants Israel dead. But it isn't limited to the terrorist groups. Palestine itself wants Israel dead. The surrounding Arab nations want Israel dead. The Persian nation of Iran wants Israel dead. My advice to Israel, just do what you have to do. Do what you need to do. Do what is right. The world will hate you no matter what action you take, and the Arabs will try to kill you no matter how much flowery talk you participate in with our State Department. You may as well just do what is right. We'll go to the phones. If you'd like to call in, it's 1-888-344-1170. And Stephen, welcome to the Bob Siegel Show.
Hiya, Bob. Thank you for taking my call.
How are you, my friend? It's been a long time.
It's been a long time. What's the consistent theme in the enemies of Israel? What is their consistent theme in addressing Israel?
Well, I would say anti-Semitism, but maybe you've got another idea.
The consistent theme, every time their stated purpose is a war of complete extermination.
That's right. And the talk about a two-state solution is just bumpkin for the masses.
Okay, now I've got a question for you. How can you tell the winner from the loser in a war of extermination?
How can you tell a winner from a loser from the war of extermination? Well, the person that... just a second. Stephen, do you have your radio or something on? We're hearing a lot of music behind.
Oh, okay. Hold on.
Yeah, go ahead and check that out. Thanks.
What's the difference? How can you tell the winner from the loser in a war of extermination?
I think the losers try to broker deals so they can come back and exterminate again some other day.
No. The loser in a war of extermination is non-existent.
That's right. That's right. And the attempts to wipe Israel out have not been very successful.
Since the German attempted genocide, the Jews have had a horrible wound in their conscience, in their consciousness. They've seen what systematic genocide is, and they've been so morally appalled by it that they're willing for people to actively engage in exterminationist policies against Jews and not reciprocate.
Yeah, you're right, my friend. Some of the worst enemies of the Jews are the Jews. The liberal Jews in America and many liberal Jews in Israel tend to take the side of the Palestinians.
At some point, the God of Israel... Since he doesn't change, when the Israelites came into the land, there were people that were so wicked that they offered their children in sacrifice, much like the Muslims who wrap bombs around their children and send them in to murder innocent Jews.
Yeah, it's a very interesting analogy. Not a whole lot has changed. Has
now, the question is, can the Jewish soul, the psyche, heal itself from that conflict with in the mid-20th century enough to understand that if they lose this, they're gone, gone.
I hope they can, Stephen, because right now Israel has all the profile of a battered wife who keeps dropping the charges against her abusive husband.
They come back, let's make up, let's be friends. They keep showing up at a knife fight with a ping pong paddle.
I mean, look at what happened with the Gaza Strip. The Palestinians were given complete rule. They voted in the terrorist organization Hamas. That's how the democracy exists. The first thing they did was burn down Jewish synagogues And then every single day fire missiles into Israel. That's what happens when they're given a separate state.
They turn the place into a rocket-firing platform. Now, if the jihadis get a hold of your children, what will they do to them?
They'll kill them in a heartbeat.
If they get a hold of your pregnant women, what will they do to the pregnant women?
Well, if they get a hold of anybody who won't convert to Islam, they'll do that. The Jews are just where they start.
Exactly. The question is, when are we going to see people who have, as a matter of religion, abandoned their humanity as the monsters that they are? Remember in the movie Casablanca, there was this guy, he was supposed to be a Czechoslovakian writer, and he escaped the Nazis, and he made his way down to Casablanca, and he was married to Ingrid Bergman, and they had to get him out, and they had to get him free into the world so that he could tell the people. What was he telling the people? He was telling the people how bad the Nazis were. In the 1940s, people did not understand how bad the Nazis were. There were huge swaths of the population who thought, well, there's nothing wrong with those guys. They're okay. They're very scientific.
And now whenever the Israelis kill a terrorist assassin, they get compared to the Nazis.
And they get, well, wait a second. We're in the same situation. The jihadis, who were at the time the strict allies of the Nazis, as a matter of fact, it was the Sharifa of Jerusalem that told Hitler how to institute the Yellow Star policy on the Jews. Remember, what's his name? The sodomite that died of AIDS. What's his name? The guy invented skyjacking. Yasser Arafat.
Oh, yes. The guy that was given the Nobel Peace Prize. Nobel Peace Prize from the United Nations.
Yes, it was his
this
uncle.
This rapist and cutthroat.
Yes, it was his uncle that implemented the
The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem was an honest-to-goodness Nazi. He wasn't just Nazi-like. He was an honest-to-goodness real Nazi.
He received an honorary Nazi title and everything. All right, so these people, who as soon as the Nazi Empire folded, became the protégés of the Soviet Union, are still in existence. They're still attempting to murder Jews. They'll murder Jews anytime they want. All we can do is pray that at some point the soul of the Jew will be healed from the wound that it received in the mid-20th century, and they will be able to show up at a knife fight with a shotgun instead of a ping-pong paddle, because this weakness is only going to get their women and their children slaughtered. It's going to make their country shrink and shrink and shrink and shrink. And who knows, maybe that's God's purpose, so that the Messiah can return and completely crush the enemies of Israel. I don't know.
Well,
I can't tell you. But to see the children of Israel defenseless or equivocating before the face of exterminationists, a brutal, anti-humane exterminationists, It rips me up. I'm spiritually, because of my faith, I identify as a member of spiritual Israel. And to see them equivocate like this, it wounds me.
It is. It's very sad. And you sound like somebody who's thought this out in a sobering way, not in the naive way that so many of the suckers do. Stephen, it's always great to hear from you, my friend.
Thank you, Bob.
Okay, have a wonderful afternoon.
You too.
When we come back from our break, we'll go back to the subject we began at the top of the hour. Would a loving God send people to hell? Your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Christians often find themselves intimidated in the midst of conversations which challenge the credibility of the Bible, especially when the subject of hell is brought up. Now, this is certainly understandable. On a first glance, the idea of somebody spending eternity separated from God or from anything good does absolutely sound like the judgment of a vindictive deity. It sounds that way. At the same time, I have found a response that invites skeptics to look beneath their own surface reactions. Observe the following sample conversation. I simply cannot and will not believe in a God who would send people to hell. Well, what about heaven? How's that? Heaven. Can you believe in a God who would send people to heaven? Yes, of course. And who will God allow into heaven? Everybody, everybody. Racists are going to heaven. Murderers are going to heaven. How about rapists? Will Adolf Hitler be in heaven? It sure doesn't sound like much of a heaven. Isn't heaven a place free from people who would harm us? Well, okay, I guess not everybody will be in heaven. Then where do the other people go? Doesn't God seem more just and therefore more loving to not allow human beings to get away with evil without some kind of accountability? I suppose. And then what about the fact that all of us in our hearts, all of us have harbored evil thoughts, thoughts of unprovoked anger, bitterness, selfishness. You see, when all is said and done, a loving God will either find a way to forgive us for the fact that we have all sinned and deliver us from this sin or banish forever from his presence those uninterested in taking responsibility for the evil side of their natures. Make no mistake, a loving God places people in both heaven and hell. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I shared a monologue about Islam, and I said that Islam was not really a religion of peace. I said, yes, there's peaceful people who call themselves Muslims, but they're not obeying their own book, the Quran. And I have in front of me an email from a man who read my Washington Times column version of that monologue. The guy that wrote me the email, his name is Mohammed. No, not the Mohammed. The article didn't make it into the other world, but the article did do enough traveling to warrant this rebuttal. It is written also as an article, but he does not list which website it is on. Otherwise, honestly, I would direct you to it so you could read it in its entirety. But he simply cut and pasted the article and then emailed it to me. His name is Mohammed Zuhair, and the title of the article of mine that he's responding to, which you can still read in my Washington Times column, Forbidden Table Talk, is entitled, A Bomber's Scapegoat. Did you hear the one about the Muslim, the Christian, and the Jew? His letter says, Dear Mr. Siegel, I have read with interest your above write-up containing some references to the Quran, which I think are not accurate. Grateful to have you read my response. Thanks and regards, yours truly, M.M. Zahir. So it was a friendly letter that he wrote me. I told him I would comment over the air and invited him to call in and respond. So maybe he will, or maybe he won't. I don't think he will, but who knows? He might. In any event, there is simply no time to read his entire piece over the air, but here are some highlights. And as I said, if he feels he's being quoted out of context, he is welcome to call in. He says in his article, I wish to be brief and get straight to the point raised in Bob Siegel's presentation. Nowhere does the Quran exhort those who believe in the book to wage war against any who will not to convert to Islam. In fact, the Quran has clear guidelines, just the opposite of Bob Siegel's misrepresentation on this point. It is important not to be confused by un-Islamic laws in certain Muslim countries where dictators repress their population in order to sustain their dictatorships. Well, I'm not doing that, my friend. Yes, my article did talk about the cruelty of many Muslim countries, but when I discussed the Quran itself, I quoted the Quran itself. He continues, back to the point, warfare or fighting is permitted in the Quran only by way of defense or self-defense. The Quran in chapter 2, verse 190 states as follows, fight in the way of Allah against those who fight against you, but begin not hostilities. Lo, Allah loveth not aggressors. So then he goes on and says, no believer can resort to fighting or warfare in violation of the above injunction. Verses in the Quran relating to warfare must be read and understood without ignoring the above verse. Well, I'm not ignoring the above verse. It does not change what the other verses say. He continues, and he's talking about chapter 9 because I quoted from chapter 9. He says, chapter 9 must be read and understood in the historical context to which that chapter itself specifically refers. The chapter relates to events during the early days of Islam. Nowhere in this chapter to which Bob has made reference or anywhere else in the Quran is there any command to Muslims to wage war against any who will not convert to Islam. Okay, now let me respond to this letter, and I do appreciate that he took the time to send this to me. Muhammad who's writing the letter, Muhammad, my friend, yes, there is such a place. I quoted it in my article. Let me quote it again. It's Surah 9. Believer, rise up and make war against the infidel around you. An infidel is defined in the Quran as anyone who will not convert to Islam. Could not possibly be more clear. Now, I do agree. I agree that context is important. Context is extremely important. So let's talk about context. In short, the Quran is filled with contradictory verses. A good many do talk about peace. A good many do talk about making war only if you've been attacked. A good many also talk about proactively starting a war. The explanation for the contradiction is simple. Muhammad originally tried to spread his religion peacefully. When that didn't work, by an amazing coincidence, he received new revelation from Allah instructing him to wage war. Now, how do you suppose he conquered Mecca? What words meant to the original author is what they mean, period. That's how we look at context, but I do appreciate your comments. Warmest regards. Well, of course, you already know our toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. A lot of people contacting me over Facebook and Twitter and by email, questions@bobsiegel.net. Got a lot of response to my thing about the socks. One of my favorites was from Marlon. His explanation of the disappearing socks is that we should either blame it on global warming or blame it on George Bush. Well, that makes a lot of sense. They blame everything else on those guys, global warming and George Bush. This one's from Lee. Bob, I don't have an explanation as to what happens to your socks, and I hate to be a killjoy here, but I do have a solution as to how to keep it from happening again. Buy yourself one of those small laundry net bags, and at the end of each day, when you take your socks off, put them in the bag. When you do your laundry, zip the bag up and throw it in the laundry. Let's see quantum physics mess with this one. Okay, Lee does seem to realize that I shared that story just to be funny, but I actually do lose those socks, so I guess he actually did give me some good advice. Thanks, Lee. Patty on Facebook says, Bob, in spite of the philosophical analysis, I think it all boils down to one thing. You're a guy, therefore you lose socks. You know, Patty, you may just be right about that. Maureen on Facebook says, I solved my missing socks dilemma by buying white socks with pink trim, which my husband would never wear. I'll keep that in mind, Maureen, just as soon as I get a wife. Maureen also comments on my thoughts about Obama's foreign policy. She says, Imam Obama's policies are pro-Muslim and pro-Muslim brotherhood. And also comments about this on Facebook. She says, so tolerance is an agreeable attitude for Obama despite the conditions and consequences of such attitude? Sheesh, what an unthinking and unfeeling policy. The same man on Facebook says this about the Washington Times version of my Israel thoughts that I shared with you today. Well done, Bob, in a timely article. Boy, do people need to read this. There has really been a concerted focus on altering historical lessons. Thank you for refocusing the discussion. Brilliant. Heather and Patty also say they liked that article on Facebook. Tammy on Facebook says, loved it. Quite helpful. Thank you. Evie says about the article, great article. Lots of ignorant people out there. They need to read their Bible, then again, possibly get one first. Well, what kinds of ignorance is Evie talking about? It has to do with some of the Washington Times readers' comments that you could read right under the article, such as this one from Teresa. She says, this article is nothing but pure Zionist propaganda. Really, Teresa? Well, if so, you didn't prove as much by your comment, did you? And then Richard says, as a British man of Anglo-Saxon heritage, I have decided to move back to Northern Europe because thousands of years ago, that was my homeland. While I am there, I will forcefully push the natives out of their homeland and kill anyone who opposes this hostility with their only option for defense, violence. Sound wrong? Obviously, it should. Israel never had a right to exist. Did you hear that? Israel never had a right to exist. To use the biblical quote-unquote excuse for imperialism and apartheid against the native population is the last refuge of a tyrant. Clever analogy, Richard. Only one problem. Nothing like that happened. Nothing even close to that happened. The Arabs were not forcefully removed from their homes. They were offered a two-state solution, and they turned it down. Most of them fled their homes or joined the attacking armies. The ones who chose to stay remained in Israel and lived peacefully as Israeli citizens. Their children are still there. Now, exactly what part of this do you not understand? As for apartheid, it does not exist in Israel. As for using the Bible to justify her existence, I'm merely talking about the history recorded in the Bible. And such history is recorded by other ancient documents contemporary to the Bible as well. If I were you, Richard, I'd brush up on the facts before offering these shameful knee-jerk reactions. And Maggie says, Bob Siegel's attempt to rewrite the history of the Palestinians and the Israelis is encapsulated in his chilling advice to a nervous Israel. My advice to Israel, just do what you have to do. Do what you need to do. Since Israel has never been a democratic nation. Did you hear that? She just said Israel's never been a democratic nation. Since Israel's never been a democratic nation, it comes as no surprise whatsoever that Siegel's bunker mentality should finally show its hollow, ugly side. Israel's pretensions of being a worthy democracy surrounded by lands full of bigots has finally been exposed forever. Israel has engaged in the deliberate manipulation and emotional blackmail of the American and European public, costing it and the world 60 years of bloodshed, hatred, and terrorism. It has made enemies of ordinary, humble Arabs who otherwise have no issue with the West. Israel is and will remain a poisonous presence in the region. Israel does not represent the aspirations of the Jewish people. It is a fake Jewish state, and no self-respecting, educated Jew has anything to do with it. It was and remains the brainchild of a few misguided European Jews, international financiers. Oh, that's what Hitler called them, too. International financiers and gullible right-wing Christians. Worst of all, there are no dignified Jews in Israel. They are just a group of low-class European Jews who have blackmailed the West following the Holocaust. Fortunately, the world has been right through the emotional ruse and the scaremongering tactics about the Muslim Brotherhood. This time, the chickens are coming home to roost. Well, my dear, I'm afraid you have it in reverse, Maggie. The historical revision is that an indigenous group of people inhabited the land for thousands of years until the nasty Jews from Europe threw them out in the 20th century. That's the historical revision. That's the lie. As for my advice to Israel, which you take issue with, I am advising them to defend themselves and not give back any more land. That's all I'm advising them to do. I'm not advising what you are implying, but the advice I did give, I stand by, proudly, because I don't conduct focus groups or polls before forming my opinion. And I'm showing my hollow, ugly side by defending Israel because Israel is not a democracy. Of course it's a democracy. Even Israel's greatest critics know this, Maggie. So what you are revealing is only your own ignorance. And Arabs have no other issue with the West other than Israel? Sure they do. It's a book called the Quran, which commands them to conquer the world. That is the problem they have with America, and that is the problem they have with Israel. We are not Muslim nations. Wake up, Maggie. And there are no dignified Jews in Israel. Do you include the many liberal Jews who take your side with the Palestinians, who verbally proclaim that side and write about that side in this state that is not a free democracy? You didn't know any of this, did you, Maggie? All you know is the anti-Semitic venom you've been taught. You make me sad for the human race. People weep over individuals like you because such arrogance mixed with ignorance is the real fuel for shameless dictators who would call a person such as yourself a useful idiot. Their words, not mine. Paul says the mistake made was the persecution of the Jewish people. The next mistake was to solve the first mistake with another mistake. You can't exclusively give land to one group when that land was never exclusively theirs. It was theirs in common with others. Two wrongs don't make a right. I have understood much, if not all, of what is said here. Well, again, Paul, the Arabs in the land were given 75% Jordan. That was not enough for them. Then they were offered half of the remaining 25% from the United Nations. They rejected that idea. Israel accepted it. And then they waged war against Israel. Wake up, my friend. There were a few people that liked what I wrote. Ralph says, Mr. Siegel, thank you for a most important report. guy that just calls himself Mr. Me says, if so many people want the Jews to move out of their historic land, I propose the following. The white and non-white population of the USA should move out immediately, the land of the Indians. Do the same thing in Australia. All Spaniards move out and let the Arabs move back in. They live there for a few hundred years. The same goes for African countries where Europeans settled over the past few hundred years. Only after the above movement of population occurs, the Jews may consider moving out of Israel if God will ask them to do that. And then a guy that calls himself Reader says, finally, somebody is telling the truth about the conflict between Israel and the so-called Palestinians. Well, we'll always continue to tell the truth here on the Bob Siegel Show, whether you like it or not. But whether you like it or not, I will be back next week at 3 o'clock. You are always welcome. Your questions are welcome, too.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.